So when you already start off the year on a good note, you start positively. So therefore, we try to cleanse ourselves as much as possible in Erev Rosh Hashanah. It's a source for minhag of fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah and other practices of getting rid of some of the ills of the previous year, Hatar Siddharim, which we're going to discuss. One of the first things you'll notice when you get up to Erev Rosh Hashanah is that we make a break on Erev Rosh Hashanah from the practice of the rest of the month that preceded it. The practice in the Ashkenazi community is to blow the shofar beginning the first day of El. This is based upon, the Torah tells us, this is based upon the Medrash that when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai to receive the Luchos Hashniyos, to receive the final set of Luchos from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there was a shofar blast that was blown in the Machaneh, that was blown in the camp, and that was to remind everybody that they should be on guard, that Moshe was going up to the mountain, they shouldn't be worried he was going to eventually come down from the mountain, they shouldn't, Chas V'Shalom, be Nichshol again in the Chayta Egel like they were the first time around. And we're told, Allah Elokim B'Sruah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Nis'ale V'Yosa Tzkiah, that when the shofar blast was blown, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, Kibiyako, was risen up, rose up together with Moshe rising up to the Har. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu rose up as well, that this showed a special sense of grace that was being demonstrated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Bnei Yisrael after the Chet Egel. So during this entire period of Eis Ratzon, of grace, of the 40 days that Moshe was up at Har Sinai, we also blow the shofar, commemorating that this is when the shofar blast was originally blown, Rosh Chodesh Elul, and that this, just like it was meant to inspire Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar to Tshuva, it's meant to inspire us to Tshuva as well, as the Pasuk says in Amos, that if a shofar is blown in the city, how can Hayitim Yitakash Shofar Beir, if a shofar blast is heard in the city, Ba'amlo Yecharadu, how can it be that the people, that the nation will not tremble? However, we take a break from this practice on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So why is it Erev Rosh Hashanah? We don't blow the shofar. So the classical answer that's given as to why we don't blow the shofar on Erev Rosh Hashanah, as stated, Mishabura quotes, is Kidei Lahavdil, in order to separate between the Tekiyah Shel Rishus and the Tekiyah Shel Chova. Others have the formulation that it's to distinguish between the Tekiyah Derabanan. This is a rabbinic decree that we blow the Tekiyah during Chodesh Elul and the Tekiyah Deraisa and the Torah obligation to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. That we make a division when we're doing an act constantly and continuously. If there wouldn't be a division, it wouldn't be clear where we were leaving off from what was the optional volunteered practice of blowing the shofar, voluntary practice, and what was the mandatory, obligatory practice of required by the Torah of blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. The Vilna Gaon says that the basis for this can be found in the Gemara in Pesachim and Daf Kuf Amud Aleph. The Gemara talks about people going into a Shabbos or a Yom Tov eating a regular meal. Let's say they began at a time they were allowed to begin eating a meal, that even if they began at an appropriate time so they didn't have to interrupt the meal, when it comes time for Shabbos and they have to suddenly stop the meal and they have to be poris mapo mekadesh and they have to set the table anew, that there should be some sort of heker. There should be some sort of recognition that we're going from a suda that was a reshus, from a meal that was an optional meal, a weekday meal, to a suda's mitzvah, to an obligatory Shabbos or Yom Tov meal. So this is the same source as the Vilna Gaon for the notion of separating between the Tekiyah Shel Rishus and the Tekiyah Shel Chovah, so why we don't blow the shofar on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Another reason that's brought down by the Mishnah Berurah is Kedei La'aveh V'Satan, is that it's meant to confuse the Satan. Why would this confuse the Satan? We don't want the Satan to prosecute us in Rosh Hashanah. If this confuses the Satan, we do a lot of things, Kedei La'aveh V'Satan. It's brought down that the Tekiyah's beginning Chodesh Elul, the Torah quotes, that one of the reasons we do it then, it's also Kedei La'aveh V'Satan. That's Kedei La'aveh V'Satan, so the Satan shouldn't exactly know when Rosh Hashanah is going to fall out, because every single day we're blowing the shofar, so the Satan gets confused. Which day is Rosh Hashanah? Which is the Yom HaDin. We also have the concept of Kedei La'aveh V'Satan to explain why we both have Tekiyos Miyusham, Tekiyos Me'umud on Rosh Hashanah, the Tekiyos that we blow before Musaf, and the Tekiyos that we blow in the middle of Musaf. So why do we have both sets of Tekiyos? It's also for that Kedei La'aveh V'Satan. Satan's going to get all confused. What's going on over here? How come there are so many Tekiyos? These people are too vigilant or too zealous in their shmir semitzos. I have no chance for them. So we do a lot of things kedei la'aviv asatan. So this is also a notion of kedei la'aviv asatan, not to blow the shofar in erev Rosh Hashanah. And here, the notion of kedei la'aviv asatan is brought down in the Achronim, is based on the notion that the satan will think that Rosh Hashanah was already over. Blowing for so many days, one of these days must have been Rosh Hashanah, and he stopped blowing. So think that the Rosh Hashanah already took place. Rosh Hashanah was already completed, and the Satan, therefore, when he doesn't hear the shofar anywhere, will go home, figure, okay, this season has ended, and I didn't get to do my damage, and now I have to go home. So that's the notion of Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, not to blow an Erev Rosh Hashanah. There's many nafkamina between these two different timing. So a potential nafkamina between these two different timing is the question as to whether you can blow the shofar privately. If, in fact, the purpose of separate, of not blowing the shofar in shul, an Erev Rosh Hashanah, is so that we don't have a ritual practice of blowing the shofar continuously from Rosh Chodesh Elul through Rosh Hashanah without a break, because we want to separate between the Tekiyas of Rishus and Tekiyas of Chova. So as long as we're not blowing in a ritual fashion in shul, then that should be okay. And if somebody wanted to practice, the Baal Tokeya, sitting right here, if we have the Baal Tokeya wants to practice an Erev Rosh Hashanah in the privacy of his room, so then he has the option to practice in the privacy of his room. According to the reason of Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, so it's important for the Satan to think that the holiday is over, we moved on to something else. So if somebody is still practicing along the shofar, the Satan will say, aha, you see, somebody is still practicing, so it must be the Rosh Hashanah hasn't taken place yet. So then the one would not even be able to practice in privacy. Something is down. The Gevurah, I think, brings down that one should not even, because of the reason of Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, one should not even practice in privacy. The Mishabura quotes sort of a compromise, which is that even though normally we say if something is also, you can't do it b'chadri chadarim, so here just Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, so we're not as worried that the Satan is going to be as concerned about what takes place in a locked room. Somebody's already in a locked room, so already this is a very private experience. Maybe it has nothing to do with Yom Tov. So if somebody locks their room and it's something that's going to be very quiet and very private, so then the Mishmur says that even if we hold like the reason of Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, it would be mutter for somebody to practice blowing the shofar on Erev Rosh Hashanah in the privacy of a locked room. The Mishabura points out that that we might consider changing the halakha this year. If you have a year in which Erev Rosh Hashanah falls out on a Friday, so then you're already going to have an automatic separation that's built in. You'll have a separation built in of the Shabbos, because when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. So therefore, since you'll have a separation anyway, maybe you should still blow the shofar on Erev Rosh Hashanah, since you're going to break up for a day anyway between Erev Rosh Hashanah and the second day of Rosh Hashanah, which will be the next time that you're going to blow the shofar. So it could be that if the reason is Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, maybe it shouldn't make a difference. The reason is Kedei La'aviv HaSatan, so the Satan already knows that you don't blow the shofar on Shabbos. So therefore, he's not going to assume that anything strange, that the holiday has passed, just because you're not blowing the shofar on Shabbos, because you never blow the shofar on Shabbos. But if the reason certainly is, in order to separate between the Tekiyah Shel Rishus and Tekiyah Shel Chovah, so you have a separation, so therefore this separation should be good enough. This reason should also work according to there are other two reasons that are given by the Chacham Shlomo as to why we don't blow the shofar on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So Chacham Shlomo says that one reason that he thought of as to why we would have a day of separation is because when we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, we make a Shechiyanah. Make a Shechiyanah. It's like you eat a new fruit, you make a Shechiyanah. So we often don't make Shechiyanahs and new fruits nowadays. It's a minute to bring out new fruits on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, because it's a question as to whether it has a new Kedushas Yom Tov or not for Shechiyanah. So to be on the safe side, when we make the Shechiyanah on the Kedushas Yom, we also bring out new fruits, and we have in mind that it should be called new fruits. But normally, over the course of most of the year, we don't make Shechiyanah new fruits. Why? Because they're usually not new. So usually we have the fruits the entire year. If they don't grow here, they grow somewhere else. We import them, we eat them the entire year, so therefore they're not new to us. So it's the same thing. We make a Shechiyanah on the shofar. So he says, it's not going to be new to us. We'll be blowing the shofar the entire month. Starting Rosh Chodesh Elul, you're blowing the shofar. So what kind of business is this? Are you making a Shechiyanah? You've been blowing the shofar nonstop in shul every single morning since Rosh Chodesh Elul. So therefore he says, that's why you have to make a separation. You make a separation because then, this is already a new fruit. This is a new shofar. This is a new type of shofar blowing. It's like he gives the example of a Prish Nisqadesh based Bar Mishana. If you have a fruit that's Nisqadesh, that it becomes, it ripens, you have a new crop two times in the same year, so you can make two Shechiyanos. So you have a second course, a second sequence of blowing the shofar. So even though you had a sequence beforehand, so you can make a shefianu at this point in time. So here too, you would have a separation of a day. You would have the separation of Shabbos between the tekiyos that you made before and now the tekiyah that you're making now. So maybe some of that should be good enough. Last time the Chokhmah Shlomo brings is that there's a medrash that says that the Malachi Asharis asks, how are we going to be Mekadosh Rosh Hashanah? And the Kodesh Baruch Hu said, well, we should all go together to the Bez and Agadol of Klal Yisrael, and they're the ones that are responsible for being Mekadosh Rosh Hashanah. And we see that there is a requirement that the people, the Klal Yisrael, Mekadosh Rosh Hashanah. So that all worked out very well when we had the days of Kiddush HaKodesh. We don't have Kiddush HaKodesh anymore, so we're not actively Mekadosh Rosh Hashanah. So therefore he says, so we're Mekadosh Rosh Hashanah by doing some sort of act the day before Rosh Hashanah to demonstrate that the next day is Rosh Hashanah. So by affirmatively not blowing the shofar, which we had been blowing up until now, and we're only not blowing the shofar in order to demonstrate that tomorrow is Rosh Hashanah, so that's sort of an affirmative act of being Mekadosh Rosh Hashanah. So here too, so I have a day in which I'm not doing anything. I have Shabbos, that I'm not blowing the shofar that I had been blowing, so maybe that should be good enough to show that tomorrow is Rosh Hashanah according to that reason. So the Shaar HaTzion, Mishnah Berurah, and the Shaar HaTzion says something very fascinating. He says that the reason why Shabbos does not count as an interruption for purposes of separating between the Tekiyos of Rishus and the Tekiyos of Chovah is because since in the davening on Rosh Hashanah day we say Zichron Truah, we say this is a remember that we say have a different nusach when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos and when Rosh Hashanah falls the rest of the week. When Rosh Hashanah falls the rest of the week, we say Yom Truah. This is a day of Truah. It's a day of blowing the shofar. When Rosh Hashanah falls on a Shabbos, we say it's Zichron Truah. This is a remembrance for the blowing of the shofar. And in fact, if you look in the Talmud Yerushalmi says that this is actually a Torah source for the notion of not blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos. That since in one place in the Torah it calls Rosh Hashanah Yom Truah, which a day of blasting the shofar. In another place in the Torah, it calls Rosh Hashanah Zichron Truah, a day of remembering the blasting of the shofar. So that's to teach us that there are certain years in which you just remember the shofar. There are certain days that you just remember the shofar. When Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, that's Zichron Truah. You don't blow the shofar. When Rosh Hashanah falls out the rest of the days of the week, then you do blow the shofar. That's Yom Truah. It happens that the Babli rejects this. The Babli says it can't be that it's Min HaTorah, that we don't blow the shofar on Shabbos, because after all, we know that we blow the shofar in the Beis HaMikdash. We wouldn't do that if it was a prohibition on Shabbos. We know that the blowing of the shofar doesn't qualify as one of the Lamites Malachos. It's just a Chokmah. It's just a very clever thing to do that we consider a shvus, a rabbinic prohibition, but it's not a Torah prohibition to blow a shofar on Shabbos. So therefore, our Gemara, the Gemara Babli, in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Kokes says that this is only a rabbinic prohibition. Shema Yavi Reno Dal Amos B'Shus Harabim. We're worried that somebody who doesn't know better is going to he doesn't know how to blow his shofar properly. He'll go to an expert and he'll walk in the B'Shus Harabim with his shofar and he'll violate on Shabbos the prohibition of carrying an object in the public domain on Shabbos. So that's the reason the Babli gives. But despite the fact that the Babli does not accept the Yerushalmi's distinction between Yom Truah and Zichron Truah as providing a Torah source as to why we don't blow the shofar on Shabbos, in our Nusach HaTfilah we accept it wholeheartedly. In our Nusach HaTfilah we have a distinction in the way that we daven on Rosh Hashanah, that if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, we say this is Zichron Truah, and the rest of the time on Rosh Hashanah, we say in the Nusach HaTfilah Yom Truah. We have this in the Kiddush on Rosh Hashanah as well. We make that distinction in the davening. So it says the Mishnah Berurah in the Shaar HaTzion, since in our Nusach HaTfilah, at least we accept this notion that Zichron Truah constitutes a reference to a kiyum, a fulfillment of blowing the shofar even on Shabbos, and on Shabbos the way that we fulfill the mitzvah of blowing the shofar is by remembering the shofar, by Zichron Truah, have a kemo tekiyah. Therefore, this is considered as if it is a tekiyah. It's considered when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos and you say Zichron Truah, it's considered as if you're actually blowing the shofar on Shabbos. On some level, the remembrance of shofar, the recitation of Zichron Truah, and the tefillos and the kiddush of Rosh Hashanah when it falls on Shabbos constitutes a fulfillment on some level of actually blowing the shofar. So therefore, you wouldn't have a separation. Since you wouldn't really have a separation because the recitation of Zichron Teruah constitutes a form of blowing the shofar in itself. Therefore, you have to have a separation on the day prior to Rosh Hashanah on Erev Shabbos. And therefore, that is why, regardless of what reason you subscribe to as to why we make the separation on Erev Rosh Hashanah for not blowing the shofar, it would be applicable even when Erev Rosh Hashanah falls out on Erev Shabbos and we will not be blowing the shofar formally the very next day. The other thing that we sort of take automatically, Erev Rosh Hashanah, come to shul, okay? So they're not blowing the shofar. Have a long slichos that's brought down in the remote. We say a long slichos because we want to make sure that before the Yom HaDin, we get in as much tshuva as possible, much begging and supplication before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So at the end of slichos, we say tachnu. At the end of slichos, we say tachnu. But at the end of davening, we don't say tachnu. We say slichos, we say tachnu at the end of slichos, but then we say shachris after slichos, and at the end of shachris, we don't say tachnu. So why don't we say tachnu? So Mishnah Berurah basically simply says, the hukamo shar Erev Yom Tov. It's like every other Erev Yom Tov. You don't say tachnun when you have an Erev Yom Tov, right? And think of every single Erev Yom Tov that you can think of. Erev Pesach, Erev Sukkot, Erev Shavuos, Erev Yom Kippur. Every other Erev Yom Tov, you don't say tachnun. So just like you don't say tachnun every other Erev Yom Tov, so you don't say tachnun this Erev Yom Tov. And then there's a whole deal, and so how can it be? If you're not supposed to say tachnun Erev Rosh Hashanah, say, how can it be at the end of slichos you say tachnun? After all, the slichos end after the beginning of day. So they explain that most of the time it's not going to end before the beginning, it's not going to end after the day has begun. Most of the time, I don't know in what community, but most of the time, most people are going to say slichos at midnight. So say slichos at midnight, so therefore when they get done with slichos, it's not going to be anywhere close to daybreak. So we say tachnun, it's not going to be morning yet. Or in those communities, they say slichos even before midnight. It's not clear you should say tachnun altogether. But he says, since most of the time the slichos are supposed to, are going to be recited before it's actually daybreak, so therefore, if a couple of times slichos ends after it's daybreak, even after it's already daytime, it's not the end of the world that we say tachnun at that time, because essentially this is a tachnun that belongs to the night. It belongs to the night. It just so happens that at your minyan you ended after daybreak, so we still say tachnun. But the fundamental premise is that as a general principle, we would work with the proposition that any tefillah that takes place on the day of Erev Rosh Hashanah, even if it's the morning, you wouldn't say tachnun. We know that if I have a real yontif, I have a Pesach, I have a Shavuos, I have a Sukkot, I have any other yontif, we know that we always have a principle that you don't say tachnun in the mincha before the yontif. You don't say tachnun even per. You have a Tainus Esther. It's a Tainus. So you figure out Tainus. Certainly, I would say tachnun. No, when Tainus Esther falls out the day before Purim, it's not a Thursday, right? But before Purim on a Sunday, then even mincha time, you don't say tachnun because the next day is some sort of yontif. So I understand Rosh Hashanah is a yontif. So I understand mincha before Rosh Hashanah. I certainly understand I wouldn't say tachnun. But why Shabbos? Why is it such a given that on an Erev Yontif you don't say tachnun just because it's an Erev Yontif? So the Drisha points out, the Drisha on the Torah points out that this assumption, which he quotes from the Magen Avraham, has this as well. The Mishnah Berurah basically just quotes it from there. This assumption that because it's Erev Yontif, you don't say tachnun, isn't clear at all. Because if you look at every other Erev Yontif, there's a good reason why you're not saying tachnun, presumably. If it's Erev Yontif Shavuos, so you have the Shloshes Yimei Hagbalah, the 3 days of purity and preparation for the receiving of the Torah that preceded Shavuos. That's for the entire 3 days. That before Shavuos, you don't say tachnun. Starting from Rosh Chodesh Sivan, you don't say tachnun. So therefore, that's the reason you don't say tachnun Erev Shavuos. If you're dealing with Erev, Sukkot, so Erev Sukkot, so the Aruch HaShulchan points out that once their Yom Kippur has been completed, so we assume that our tefillos have been accepted and that we have been forgiven and we've received full kapara for all of our sins. So therefore, these are Yemei Simcha. These are considered to be days of happiness. It's all Yemei Simcha. That's why we don't say tachnun at all following Yom Kippur. So we don't say tachnun already Yud Aleph Tishrei. We don't say tachnun Yud Beis Tishrei. So certainly we don't say tachnun Yud Aleph Tishrei either. It has nothing to do with the fact that it is Erev Sukkot. Erev Yom Kippur. Even the Mishnah Berurah quotes as to why there's a sip in the Shulchan Aruch later on that says in Erev Yom Kippur we don't say tachnun in the morning. So why don't we say tachnun in the morning? It says because we treat it k'tzas like a yontif. We treat it like a little bit of a yontif. that there's a din in Erev Yom Kippur, that there's a mitzvah to eat an Erev Yom Kippur, you're supposed to feast, you're even supposed to cut down on your learning so you'll have more time to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. And he says that it's considered like an inoy on the ninth day of Tishrei. Why is it an inoy, an affliction? Because if you eat on Erev Yom Kippur, it's considered as if you fasted for an extra day. You actually get credit for fasting. It's a special mitzvah of eating. Special mitzvah of eating, so it's a special, it's a yantiv on some level. So that's quoted by the Achronim, that Erev Yom Kippur is considered to be a yantiv on some level. So we understand why we don't say Tachno on Erev Yom Kippur in the morning. What about Erev Pesach? So Erev Pesach is a question. Erev Pesach is a question. The Beis Yosef seems to indicate that Erev Pesach may be simply because of the fact that it's an Erev Yontif. Maybe that's the reason why you don't say Tachan. Maybe there is something special there, and that always on Erev Yontif you don't say Tachan. He says, why is it that we don't say Tachan in the entire month of Nisan? That's a halakha in Shulchan Aruch. You don't say Tachan in the entire month of Nisan. So why is it? What's the source of this minhag? So he says, because the first 12 days, he holds the first 13 days, the first 12 or 13 days, depending on when the first korban of the Nisim was brought, the Nisim brought the korbanos. The Medrash indicates that the Nisim, the princes of the tribes, in the Chanukah Samishkan, started bringing korbanos already from the first day of Nisan. Beis Yosef, for some reason, seems to indicate that it started the second day of Nisan. But either way, either the first 12 or the first 13 days of Nisan, it's either Rosh Chodesh or a day, and or a day in which the Nisim were bringing their korbanos. So therefore, these were all Yamim Tovim, these were all holiday days in which these special korbanos were being brought. These were days of festivity. And then you have all the days of Pesach itself. And then you have Yisrochag after Pesach. He assumes he wouldn't say Tachan on Yisrochag, separate discussion. And then you have Erev Yontif. So you have so many days already. Most of the month has passed Bikdusha with great holiness and sanctity. So therefore, the assumption is that since so much of the month already you have 14 days plus another 7, 7 or 8, plus another 1. So you have over 20 days in which you didn't have to say Tachan. So already the rest of the month goes along with that. So he seems to indicate that Erev Pesach doesn't necessarily have a special reason other than being Erev Pesach for not saying Tachan. But others say no. Others say that the Erev Pesach, that the Mechodesh Nisan, I don't have to specifically add up all of the days to figure out a majority of days in order to justify not saying Tachan the rest of the month. The reality is, if I just had the first 12 days at the Nisim Bwata Kabanas and the 8 days of the 7 days in Eretz Yisrael and the 8 days outside of Eretz Yisrael of Pesach, that already adds up to most of the month. So I don't need to ever Pesach anyway. But the Aruch HaShulchan says that the reason you don't say Tachanun in Nisan is because Nisan was such a happy day, that this is a happy month. This was the month of the Geula. This is the month of the Beis Hamikdash is going to be built in the future. So that's why you don't have to nitpick on whether this day is an appropriate day not to say Tachanun or not. Just the whole month is so happy and so joyous and so wonderful. That's why we don't say Tachanun. So therefore, for that reason alone, it doesn't necessarily show that there's a special din that you don't say Tachanun on an Erev Yontif because you don't say Tachanun on an Erev Pesach. And that's in addition to the fact, Erev Pesach is a day that's also, at least Michatzos Vahala, from midday and onwards, it's Aser in Malacha. There's an Issa Malacha because there was a requirement to be Osik in Korban Pesach. And even nowadays, that we don't have the Korban Pesach, we still have a prohibition of doing Malacha in the afternoon, with certain exceptions. There's a prohibition of doing Malacha in the afternoon, very similar to Chol HaMoed, on Erev Pesach. So therefore, you can argue that Erev Pesach also has a little bit of a din of a yantar, but there's no Issa Malacha on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So therefore, the Drisha says, I can come up with a good reason not to say Tachanun every other Erev Yontif, but I don't really have a good one for Erev Rosh Hashanah, unless you accept this premise that the Mishnah Berurah quotes, that, oh, it's an Erev Yontif, so I don't say Tachanun. But if I don't accept that premise, that intrinsically on an Erev Yontif, there's a reason not to say Tachanun, I have to come up with another reason. So the Levush, I put on the Mara Mekomos, I don't think it got duplicated, but I have it here anyway. The Levush is quoted in the Chidush HaGos on the bottom of the Torah as basically saying that the reason why you don't say Tachnun is because it's a Yantav b'nei she'ana b'tzuchim HaKadosh Baruch Hu she'yislach lanu. The reason we don't say Tachnun is because this is a Yantav because we have faith and confidence in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he's going to forgive us for our sins. And if you look at the Lashon of the Torah, this is very meduyak. Because the Torah has a whole elaboration about how Erev Rosh Hashanah, we don't treat it the way that you would think through your first blush that one would go about approaching an Erev Rosh Hashanah. as you might, if normally if somebody has a din, somebody has a court case, somebody's about to appear before the judge for sentencing, so the person's going to wear very sober clothing and the person is going to be very sad and the person is not going to be able to eat or anything and the person's going to be extremely nervous and they'll be shaking and quaking in their boots and so forth. And the Torah says, but we don't have that approach. We have such tremendous confidence that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to forgive us for all of our sins, that we're rochatzin and we're stopperin, we wash and we take a haircut and we shave and we cut our nails and we eat and we drink both before and after Rosh Hashanah itself, and therefore he says lefikach, therefore nogin lesapir lechabes v'erev Rosh Hashanah, therefore there is a minog to cut one's hair and to wash oneself on erev Rosh Hashanah in order to show the great confidence that we have in the judgment of the day. And then after the Torah brings down this niug, this practice of having such tremendous happiness in one's preparation for Rosh Hashanah, the Torah mentions kind of as an afterword, oh, and by the way, v'nogin v'ashkenaz she'ein nefilas apayim v'erev Rosh Hashanah, the minhag in Ashkenaz is that we don't do tamid v'erev Rosh Hashanah, kimo b'shar arvei yomim tovim. Just as with respect to other arvei yomim tovim. So you could read this the way the Drisha reads it, that he's saying, oh, simply because it's an Erev Yontif, therefore we don't say Tachanun. But another way to read this is along the lines of Lavush, that he's saying, because of the fact that we have such tremendous confidence, that we're betuchim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sheyislach lanu, that we're confident that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will forgive us, that's the reason why it has a shtickle essence of Yontif to it, and that's the explanation as to why there's a minhag of not saying Tachanun and Erev Rosh Hashanah. The most prevalent or popular practice that everyone's familiar with when they go to davening in Erev Rosh Hashanah is the practice of Hataras Nedar, the practice of nullifying all of their vows that may exist from the previous year or the previous years. In this sense, of course, our religion is diametrically opposite from all of the other religions of the world, because basically the general worldview towards the advent of a new year, towards the new year, is, ah, it's new year, I better make my new year's resolutions. So when it comes to Judaism, we're exactly the opposite. When it comes to you, we say, ah, it's new year, I better nullify all of my resolutions. So that's basically we have the opposite approach. Why do we have the opposite approach? Because it's hard enough to stick to the basics. It's hard enough to do that, the Tariq Mitzvahs, the things that we're absolutely obligated to do. So therefore, we recognize that it's not a good idea to put ourselves at peril on a day of judgment by taking upon ourselves additional vows, additional obligations, additional commitments. It's good enough if we keep all the things that we're supposed to keep. So therefore, we nullify all of our resolutions. That's our big party right before Rosh Hashanah. Let's go and nullify all of our resolutions. Okay? Did you nullify any resolutions? Yeah, I nullified all my resolutions. Excellent. Okay. That's New Year's for us. So there are a number of questions that arise with respect to the practice of Hataras Nedarim. First of all, why do we do it now? So the Shaarei Tshuva quotes that we have all kinds of Muslim. We have all kinds of hints as to what Elul stands for. So, for example, the most popular one is Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, that Elul is the Rosh Tepos of I am for my beloved and my beloved is for me. A reference to our close relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But there are other Ramazim as well. So one of the other Ramazim is Lo Yachel Dvaro Kekol. That the Torah says, Lo Yachel Dvaro, and Pashas Matos, you should not violate your word when you make a neder. Kekol Yotzim Pivyaseh, everything that you say, you're supposed to do. So the words, Lo Yachel Dvaro Kekol, basically the last letter of every single one of those words, Lo Yachel Dvaro Kekol, spell out Elul. They spell the last letters of every single word spell out Elul. So therefore, during Chodesh Elul, that's why the practice is, says the Shaarei Tshuva, to do Hataras Nedarim. Why do we do it the last day of Elul? So I saw quoted by Rabbi Yitzchak Shtosman, who has a very nice sefer on Hilchos Nedarim. So he quotes a sefer, the Rosh Yosef, as saying that because this is based on the Gemara Nedarim. The Gemara Nedarim says that the Rabbi Yanai Saba, whenever somebody would come to him to nullify a vow, so he would say, had you known that your vows are written in your ledger, and they're going to be reviewed up high, very, very closely, every single vow is on your official ledger, then would you have taken the vow? And that's the way that he would get people to cancel their vows. So he says, when you're coming up to Rosh Hashanah, so this is when our ledger is being examined. Everybody has their ledger examined, so everybody wants to have a clean ledger. And they don't want all their vows and their commitment to their vows being examined so carefully when it comes to Rosh Hashanah. So therefore, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we want to make sure that our ledgers are clean, and we have a basis to do it during Kodesh Hel anyway, so we do it Erev Rosh Hashanah. I was thinking, although nobody said this, that, you know, since maybe we're deriving it from the last letters of every single word of Lo Yechel Baruch Yechol, so therefore we say not only is it Chodesh Elul, but it's the end of Chodesh Elul that you should be Matzah Nedarim, because it's the last letters of every single word. Nobody said that, but I was thinking of that. So the Aruch HaShulchan says explicitly that the minhag is to be Matzah Nedarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So this is an interesting, sometimes often busy type of atmosphere in which everybody's running around. Can you join me in my team? Can you join me? Which could be do it this way, that way. So everyone's scrambling at the end of davening Erev Rosh Hashanah to do a Taras Adarim. So how do you do it correctly? And what does it work for? So Rabbi Kiva Eger says that the Shulchan Aruch points out that you can do a Taras Adarim with Krovim. You're allowed to do a Taras Adarim with relatives. Normally when you have Dayonim, the Yonim are not supposed to be related to you. But it comes to a Taras Nedarim, so it's low-key, you're allowed to have relatives. But he said, even though you can have relatives, they have to be kosher Dayonim in other contexts, meaning they have to normally be people who would be allowed to sit as Dayonim. It's just that it's not going to be a psul, it's not going to be a disqualification, the fact that they're related to you. But they have to be people who, if they weren't related to you, could sit on a Beis Din. So, for example, somebody who's not qualified to be a Dayan, a woman is not supposed to be a Dayan, according to Halacha. So a woman is not allowed to sit on the Beis Din for Hataras Nedarim, according to Rabbi Akiva Eger. So it's not as if every single person who's normally disqualified as a Dayan could sit as a Dayan for Hataras Nedarim. You appear before a Beis Din, but it has to be people who would normally be able to sit as Dayan. They can normally sit as a Beis Din, but normally if they were related to you, they couldn't be a Beis Din. But now, if your uncle, your brother happens to be on the Beis Din, it's not a disqualification, they could be on the Beis Din. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik used to say, based on this comment of Rabbi Akiva Eger, that what this means is that the Beis Din unit itself has to be a kosher Beis Din unit. Not only that the people of the Beis Din have to be people who would normally be qualified to serve as Dayanim, but that the Beis Din unit has to be a kosher unit. So if I have a Beis Din where two of the Dayanim are related to each other, that's not a kosher unit of a Beis Din. So therefore he says, even though one relative is allowed to be on the Beis Din panel, you're not allowed to have two relatives who are related to each other serving on the Beis Din panel. That was a chumrah that the Rav Aaron Soloveitchik had. So that's one thing to bear in mind based on that Rabbi Akiva Eger. The other question that everybody asks about a Taras Nedarim is that normally we have a halacha that one is supposed to be mefaret the neder. One is supposed to spell out when they want to be matar a neder. You took upon yourself a certain practice, and now you want to be freed from having to observe that practice. So normally you have to specify. I took upon myself to fast every Monday and Thursday during the following period, and now I can't do it anymore for such and such reason. You have to explain. You have to spell it out. This is the machlokas in the Gemara and Gittin and Daf Lamed Hey Amud Beis between Rav Nachman and Rav Papa as to whether you have to, in order to do Hataras Nedarim, whether you have to spell out the neder or not. And we pass them like Rav Papa, the one is obligated to spell out the neder. Why is one obligated to spell out a neder? So Rav Papa says, because maybe Mishum Milsa de Yisura, maybe you took upon yourself a neder in order to strengthen yourself in terms of your shmiras and mitzvahs. That you said, I'm not going to do an avera, that the following food should be prohibited to me if I should do an avera. So we don't want to nullify a neder that's now going to free you up to do an avera. So that's not a positive thing. We want you to stay away from avera. So therefore, we have to make sure that the neder that you want to be released from is a neder that it's proper to be released from. So that's normally why one has to be mefarid a neder. But what happens if one's not mefarid? What happens if one doesn't specify the neder? So is the Hataras Nedarim still good? Here, nobody specifies anything. They just say, all the Nedarim I want to be batal, all the Nedarim I want to nullify. So maybe the whole thing doesn't work. So that's what some taina, that the Hataras Nedarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah, it doesn't really work. It doesn't really accomplish anything in terms of nullifying any actual vows. So here you have a number of different shittos as to what the mechanism is for working. So according to the Teferes Yisrael Mishnayos, on the beginning of the seventh parak of Mishnayos Bechoros, so he claims that this principle that you have to specify in neder is only l'chatchila. Only l'chatchila, it's not something which is me'akev, it's not something which is indispensable, it's something which is a preference. But if you didn't do it, you could still, the neder is still considered to be nullified anyway. Then there's the shita of the the sefer Elef Hamogim by Ephraim Margolius on the sefer Matzei Ephraim. So he says that it works if I don't remember a neder. It could be I took 100 nedarim, I only remember 60. The other 40, so those 60 I have to spell out. But the 40 I don't remember. So it could be I took upon myself 40 different nedarim that I don't remember. So those 40 I'll never be able to spell out. So since there may be lots of nedarim, you said I'll take a neder to do this, I take a neder to do that, but you don't remember those nedarim. So those nedarim that you don't remember, so Ataras nedarim Rosh Hashanah works. That's his diet. The Rosh Hashanah works for those nedarim that you've forgotten. But Shlomo Kluger says that you have to look at Shlomo Kluger has a sefer nedarim called Kinuyei Nedarim, which is a sefer in which he goes to Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Nedarim, and he has Shailos Hashuvos. So he says you have to look at the text of Ataras Nedarim. What does the text say in Ataras Nedarim? The text I have it open up in front of me, you know, of Ataras Nedarim. So the text at the end of Ataras Nedarim says Ve'ein ani mevakesh atara al osam hanedarim she'ein lahater osam. I am not asking you to nullify those vows that it would be inappropriate for me to nullify. So if you say explicitly that you're not asking to be released from those vows that it's inappropriate for you to be released from, so then there is no requirement to be mefareh to neder. There's no requirement to specify the neder. The Gemara says the only reason there's a requirement to specify the neder is maybe we'll discover this is a neder that you should not be nullifying. But if you say explicitly you don't want to nullify those nedarim that would be inappropriate to nullify, so you're excluding all of those nedarim anyway, so all the other nedarim which would be appropriate to nullify, you don't have to specify, and those are considered to be canceled, those are considered to be nullified. Now, Ravadi Yosef says something else very interesting in the context of actually the other part of Ataras Nedarim. The other part of Ataras Nedarim, one part is that you're nullifying your vows, and the other part is what we call a Mesiras Moda, that you are making a proclamation that all future vows should be null and void. So that notion of making a proclamation that all future vows should be null and void, that's what we say at the very end. After the Dayanim say Mutalach, 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 so you get up in front of the Dayanim and you say, Hare ani Moseh Moda lifneichem. I am informing all of you that I'm being mevatil, I'm nullifying mitana laba and in the nedarim that I'm going to take in the future. So that way you don't have to worry about any future nedarim. So everybody asks, how does that mechanism work? That mechanism is based on the Gemara Nedarim, on Chof Gimel Amid Beis. It says that a person can get up at the beginning of the year and he can say, I want to nullify all of my future vows. And then there's a question in the Gemara as to whether that works only if you forget about this declaration when you take the vow. So you forgot about this declaration when you took the vow, so that means that you didn't, that had you remembered the declaration, you would have wanted to nullify the vow. It's just that you, that's why you made the declaration at the beginning of the year. So if you should ever slip up and make a vow, so it should be covered by your declaration to nullify all future vows. And the other opinion, it's not clear if the other opinion argues or not. The other opinion in the Gemara says, well, this is only if you remember within the time that you took the vow. If you didn't make an absolute declaration, it was only a partial declaration. It's a little bit of a fuzzy or difficult shita in the Gemara. So there's a machlokis among the Rishonim as to whether the second opinion in the Gemara argues with the first opinion in the Gemara. Whether we hold like the first opinion of the Gemara, that if you made a declaration to nullify all future vows, it's a baye. If you made an opinion to nullify all future vows, and then you took a vow and didn't remember that declaration, whether that means that the vow is automatically canceled, or whether, no, you have to remember the declaration within a few seconds of the vow, and have in mind that you want that declaration to cover the vow, but if you didn't have in mind sort of this b'li neder qualification of the vow at the time you took the vow, then you're not covered. So that's a question. And the Ramah in Hilchos Nedarim says that you should not rely really on this type of declaration. So you shouldn't rely on this type of declaration. So why are we making it all together if you can't rely on this type of declaration? So that's a question, whether you can rely on this type of declaration or not. So there's a very famous shita of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was a famous personality in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim. Right? Wasn't he called the guardian of Yerushalayim, I think? Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was a very, very famous Torah personality in the early days, I guess, of the Medina, Eretz Yisrael. So Yosef Chaim, the new establishment of the Yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael, I should say. So Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld had a person by the name of Shlomo Sobel. I guess Reb Shlomo Sobol. Okay, Smicha. Reb Shlomo Sobol was considered a learned person in his own right. And I don't know if he drove around with Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, what the relationship was, but apparently he was always having conversations with him. So every time he had a conversation with Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, he recorded the conversation. So he asked him hundreds and hundreds of questions, and every time he asked him a question, so he recorded the question, he recorded the short answer that Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld gave. He usually gave very short answers, like yes, no, I think it's a good idea, yeah, Mistover, it works, whatever it was. And he put them all down in a sefer, and the sefer was called Samas Chaim. And you don't really hear the sefer quoted a lot. But when it comes to this one shita, with respect to Ataras Nedarim, everybody under the sun quotes this this short tshuva by Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, based on this question that was posed to him. So this is in Chelek Beis, Simen Lamed Ches, of the Samas Chaim. And basically, the questioner said, if somebody was Mosim Odah, somebody gave this type of declaration that they're nullifying all vows in the future on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So he says, what if we're not dealing with a case where a person made an explicit vow? But the Gemara says that sometimes a person does something and we treat it like a vow. Like a person decides they're going to start a new nice minhag. They're going to start a nice minhag, they're going to fast a certain day of the year, but they don't say explicitly they're taking it as a vow. A nice minhag that they're going to stand up during Kriya Satorah, some sort of nice minhag, but they don't say at the time that they're starting the minhag that I'm taking a neder to do this mitzvah, to do this niyu. They just do it, say, three times, and then there's, based on the Gemara Nedarim Tesvav Amud Aleph, the halacha is that if you take on a nice minhag three times, so that already counts as a neder. That already counts as a neder. So the Rosh and that Gemara and others who say that already counts as a neder. So he says, what about this type of practice where the person isn't explicitly making a neder, it's just a minhag tov that a person observed, but they don't want to observe it anymore. Can they rely on the Hataras Nedarim of the Mesiras Modah of Erev Rosh Hashanah when the person said any future vow should be nullified, and then they end up taking a minhag tov? So are they covered by their initial declaration that the minhag tov that they adopted thereafter should not be binding upon them? And Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld has this entire tshuva is six words. It's amazing how much mileage these six words have gotten. He says, Mistava Kidvarav. Yeah, makes sense. I think you're right. Vidakam Noda Beferish. It's only if a person made an explicit vow. He said, I already know there. He took an explicit vow during the course of the year that we would be worried that maybe that overrode the original declaration. But if it was not in the form of an explicit vow, so then the Mesiras Modah and Erev Rosh Hashanah would cover any kind of Minhag Tov. This is quoted approvingly by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in the Minchas Shlomo Simen Sadi Aleph Sif Chof. Shlomo Zalman Orbach adds that if a person takes on other types of obligations, like he says, I'm going to learn something, but he doesn't say it in a Lashon of Neder, but the Gemara and Dharm Daf Ches indicates that that also is binding upon a person like a Neder, based on the principle, the Ran says, Beficha Zutztaka, that if you just say something to give Tztaka, so that already counts like a Neder to give Tztaka. So a person says they're going to do any mitzvah, the Ran says that that counts like a Neder to do the mitzvah, even if they didn't use a Lashon Neder. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach suggests that the Mesiras Modah that start an Erev Rosh Hashanah would work for all of those things as well. Anytime a person said, yeah, let's get together and we'll learn regular, we'll have a regular Seder, whatever, and then it becomes difficult to do that Seder, he wants to do a different Seder. Not that he's going to start, you know, doing a Veiros instead, but there's any type of Nihu Tov that a person didn't adopt with a Lashon Neder, so he feels, he expands upon this notion of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, it seems, that he indicates that he thinks that the Mesiras Modah, Erev Rosh Hashanah, might cover for that as well. So Ravadi Yosef, in a short comment, that he makes, hard to know how broadly to extrapolate from this short comment. He makes a short comment in his tshuvos in Yabia Omer Chelik Beis Simen Lamed and Orachayim. At the end of that tshuva, he talks about the Hataras Nedarim of Erev Rosh Hashanah. He also quotes this tshuva of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. And he's talking about a woman who had accepted upon herself a Nihu Tov, and now it's becoming difficult for her to continue the practice of what she was doing, to take upon herself certain mitzvahs that she wasn't commanded to perform, and now she wants to be able to be discharged from that obligation. So among the other svaras that he gives to Bimekel, he says that he thinks that she would be able to rely upon the Hataras Nedarim of Erev Rosh Hashanah. And he says, because, after all, this is just a Nihu Tov, and when Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld says that you could rely upon the Mesiras Modah, you could rely upon the the declaration, the cancellation of future vows that takes place at Erev Rosh Hashanah with respect to a niyutov. So he said he thinks that the same way that it's a little treated a little bit more leniently with respect to what's encompassed or what counts for your cancellation of future vows, so too, even though the Hataras Nedarim or Erev Rosh Hashanah is problematic because the person doesn't specify the Nedarim, it doesn't have the normal formalities of Hataras Nedarim, he thinks that Hataras Nedarim as well, the cancellation of previous vows, would also be able to work more effectively with respect to this type of Niyut, with respect to this type of Minhag Tov. Now, I say that I have difficulty knowing how much to extrapolate from that tshuva, because Rav Avadya Yosef also has a tshuva in Chelek Aleph of Yechaveh Das, his other volume of Shailos HaTshuvos. Yechaveh Das were the Shailos HaTshuvos that were based upon his radio addresses. He would give radio addresses covering various topics and various questions, and they were all compiled in six volumes of Yechaveh Das. Yibi Omer, his other volume, his other collection of tshuvas are much more lengthy, they're much more detailed and longer than the tshuvas in Yechaveh Das. But he has a tshuva in Yechaveh Das, in Chelek Aleph, of somebody who had always been fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah, and now they wanted to stop fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah. We'll get to that in 2 minutes, fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah. Hope we'll get to it, maybe we'll get to it. So he has a tshuva on fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah, and he says that there's somebody who wanted to be discharged from this regular vow of fasting on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So he said that if the person just was unable to do it because there was an onus, there was some special reason, one given year, that they were unable to fulfill this particular mitzvah, so then they would not need a special hatara because they're an onus, they're an onus, they're under duress, and they're going to go back to it, so one would not need a special hatara, based on another Yehuda. But if the person really wants to be released forever, so then he says that you can't rely on the Hataras Nedarim of Erev Rosh Hashanah because you have to specify the nether explicitly. So that case seems to be talking about somebody who's just doing it as a minhag, not a person who said, Hareini Noder, I'm taking a nether that I'm going to do this forever and ever. So therefore, I'm not sure exactly how to reconcile those two tshuvas. There are others that say that the Hataras Nedarim of Erev Rosh Hashanah is primarily effective not to discharge any previous Nedarim, but rather, it's meant to be a kapara. It's meant as a, like some say this with respect to Kol Nidre, that it's meant to be a kapara, that the person's just trying to get a forgiveness for any vows that he may have violated. Not that he's going to be necessarily able to cancel any previous vows, but basically just that it's going to serve as a kapara. And that's supported a little bit by the Lashon of the Dayanim who say about Yeshka Mechila Slicha VeKapara, that we're kind of trying to help you get you a Mechila Slicha VeKapara, a forgiveness for all this, for all the vows that that you nullified. But at the very least, whatever the Hataras Nedarim accomplishes, there seems to be a general consensus that the Mesiras Modah, the cancellation of future vows, is certainly effective with respect to Hanhagas Tovas, with respect to good practices that people accept upon themselves afterwards, but they just forget to say a Lashon of Bli Neder. Just briefly, there's a little bit of a discussion about a strange Lashon in the Hataras Nedarim, where there's a contradiction between two versions of the Artskol Siddur. If you look in the Artskol Siddur, some have the old version, I think, of the Artskol Siddur, when it says, I am nullifying all of the vows that I may have taken. So the old version of the Siddur says, Afilu Nazir Shimshin. I'm sorry, it says, Chutz Nazir Shimshin. Everything except for Nazir Shimshin, I cannot nullify Nazir Shimshin. Meaning, if a person takes upon themselves to be a Nazir, normally that's something that can be nullified. But if you took upon yourself to be a Nazir, Shimshon, Shimshon was what? Shimshon was a Nazir who was told by a Navi before he was born that he had to be a Nazir for life, so he wasn't able to nullify that. So somebody says, I'm going to be like Shimshon, so he'll never be able to nullify that Nazir. So therefore, since it'll never work to nullify that Nazir, so you say, I'm everything except for Nazir Shimshon. So others said, why should we exclude the possibility of Nazir Shimshon? Maybe we'll find some possibility to find some grounds to even be able to nullify Nazir Shimshon. So therefore, others have the text, Afilu Nazir Shimshon, that you can nullify even Nazir Shimshon. If you look at all the old versions of Hataras Nedarim, the old versions of Hataras Nedarim all say Afilu Nazir Shimshon. We all say even Nazir Shimshon. And the Pesachei Tshuva asked on that, how can it be? The Gemara says you can't nullify Nesivah Shimshon, so the article changed the text, the Chutzpah Nesivah Shimshon. Then in the latest version they have a Fila Nesivah Shimshon, they have a footnote on the bottom that says some texts say Chutzpah Nesivah Shimshon. So Lemaisa, I'm not sure why one has to say anything at all. How many of us ever come close to even saying anything that remotely resembles Nesivah Shimshon? Maybe leave well enough alone and say nothing, I don't know. Just a suggestion. I let the poskim who designed the text of the Sidurim consider the possibility that maybe you don't have to say either Afilu Nezivah Shimshon or Chutzpah Nezivah Shimshon. You don't have to say anything. Others who say, yeah, maybe it works to nullify Nezivah Shimshon if you haven't yet started to practice Nezivah Shimshon, you just made the nether, or you just said you'll take upon yourself the aspects of Nezivah Shimshon, but you didn't say Nezivah Shimshon outright, or you did it al tanai, you did it on condition, maybe then you can nullify it. So there are grounds for leaving in the text of Afilu Nezivah Shimshon, according to many authorities, based on the assumption that there are certain types of Nezivah Shimshon that would be susceptible to nullification, and why limit yourself. But I have to admit, it seems strange to me to make a Hataras Sedarim and specifically exclude a category of Nedda. Why take it out of the parsha altogether? Why say Chutzpah Nezivah Shimshon? Maybe it'll work. Maybe there is some type of Nezivah Shimshon that can be nullified according to some postings. So I'm not sure if Chutz is. I'm not sure. Given that one wants to take themselves off the hook, I'm not sure what Chutz accomplishes exactly. So I'll speak just briefly in the next few minutes. We have Bob. How much do we have? 5 minutes. 3 minutes. Okay, 3 minutes. Okay. So there's a practice of fasting on Erev Rosh Hashanah. The practice of fasting on Erev Rosh Hashanah, the Torah says that if you have a king who's coming to a city and he just imposed a large tax that nobody can pay, so that's like on some level a Kaddish Baruch Hu coming and we're worried about everything that we'll have to pay for all of our actions. So if you have a delegation of a few people who comes out while the king is 10 parsos away, So the king will forgive one third of the tax. And then you have another delegation that comes, says the king gets a little closer, he'll forgive another third, and then everybody comes out, when the king's finally arriving, and then he'll forgive the rest of the tax. That's the mashal. So he said, so that's the same thing, that there are a very small group of people who fast on Erev Rosh Hashanah, and that helps to forgive one third of the sins. And then during Aseret Yemei Teshuva, more people fast. It used to be a more widespread minhag for people to fast during Aseret Yemei Teshuva. And in order to get a full 10 days, they would add 4 days before Rosh Hashanah as well, because the 4 days during Aseret Yemei Teshuva, you can't fast. 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur, and the Shabbos. So they would add another 4 days. So that was another sequence of fasts. So they would get more forgiveness. And then Yom Kippur, so then that would be that would clean everybody's slate. So so there was in the early practice of fasting in Erev Rosh Hashanah for this reason. So even today, there are a number of people. I don't know how many. There are a number of people who fast in Erev Rosh Hashanah. But this fast, the Mishnah Berurah brings down in Siman Tav Kuf Samach Beis, this fast is one, and in this Siman, this fast is one which the custom is not to do it the entire day. The custom is just to do it until Mincha. And the custom became just to do it till Mincha Gedolah, so just basically till a little bit after Chatzos. And normally, when one takes upon a fast, then they have to be mekabel it. They have to accept it upon themselves in Mincha the previous day. But this is such a well-known fast that it doesn't require a special Kabbalah if somebody gets into the habit of fasting on Erev Rosh Hashanah. And the Mishnah Berurah brings down that according to most poskim, there's a dissenting view of the Shelos Yabetz, but according to most poskim, you can even say Aneinu. If you're fasting, even though you're going to break the fast right after Mincha, a Yachid says Aneinu in his Shmona Esrei. So that's the practice. For those who fast on Erev Rosh Hashanah, they find the Mincha Minyan right after Chatzos, half hour after Chatzos. Sometimes hard to find. Some communities, it's very hard to find. I remember growing up in Muncie that everyone would go to the Boxwood Rebbe Minyan. There was one Minyan that happened to have an early Mincha on Erev Rosh Hashanah. So you show up there and you'd see a lot of familiar faces. That was sort of the official, the early Erev Rosh Hashanah Minyan. And after, during the Minyan, you say Aneinu. And then after the Minyan is over, so then the people who fast Erev Rosh Hashanah are allowed to eat after Mincha. There is a shita of the Taz, which I saw is followed in the Rosh in the Machzor, the article Machzor. They follow the shita of the Taz that when you say Aneinu in Shema Kolenu, the words of Ki Biyom Samtan Senu are omitted, because since the one is not going to fast the entire day, So therefore, a yom tzom tani seinu is only appropriate if one is going to fast an entire day. So therefore, the words of yom tzom tani seinu are omitted in the prayer. Some say you can still say it, but it seems like the more popular practice, at least as reflected by the sitter, is like the taz to take out those words. 1 minute with respect to the minhag of being tovel in Erev Rosh Hashanah, the Ramah brings down the minhag to go to the mikvah in Erev Rosh Hashanah. I think the more popular minhag is to go to the mikvah in Erev Yom Kippur, not Erev Rosh Hashanah. This is an interesting comment by the Mishnah Berurah based on the Ari to do it the fifth hour of the day, or do it 1 hour before Chatzos, the sixth hour of the day. So the question is, why the sixth hour of the day? Why before it's even mincha? Why wait until then? Why do it at that point in time? So there's a discussion that's printed in an article by Rabbi Palmer based on a shiur that Rav Shechter gave, that this might be based on the comment of a Mekubal by the name of Yosef Shapira, quoted in the Sefer Moedim Muzmanim, who quotes the Arizal as saying that when one is Mekabel Shabbos as a general matter, it's good to go to the mikvah. For those who go to the mikvah, Erev Shabbos, like the fifth hour of the day, if one is doing it in Eretz Yisrael, because that's a time in which at some point in the world, if you're living in Australia, Shabbos has already begun. So he says that's the reason maybe why the Mishnah Berurah here says to start going to wait until that point in time, because it's already a Kedushas Rosh Hashanah somewhere in the world. So if you're living in America, you could probably start as early as 3 in the morning, if that was the idea of the minhag. It wasn't clear to me that that's necessarily the only interpretation. You look in Hilchos Yom Kippur, they bring down to go to the mikvah the seventh hour of the day, on Erev Yom Kippur. Why the seventh hour? The Shas Mincha. The idea is you go to the mikvah, and right afterwards you go to Mincha. So it could be that the intention that the Mishnah Berurah is, you go to the mikvah the sixth hour of the day, and then right after Chatzos, you'll daven Mincha. So it's not entirely clear that that's the intention of the Mishnah Berurah here. So I'll just end with a comment by... by Eliyahu Lopian in his Sefer Lev Eliyahu. He quotes the Saba Miklem. So Saba Miklem says, why do we have this sort of contradictory approach towards Erev Rosh Hashanah? On the one hand, Erev Rosh Hashanah is a day of tremendous solemnity, and we're saying the long slichos, and we're atoning for our nedarim of the previous year, and many have a minhag to have a tainus for half a day in Erev Rosh Hashanah. On the other hand, the Torah mentions it's a day when mechapsin and mestaprin, that we get all excited and we get haircuts and we get dressed and we wash up and we put on our nicest clothes and we're confident. We don't say takana and we're confident in the judgment of Kadosh Baruch Hu that we're all going to be judged l'tov. So why is this sort of contradictory approach? So he explains there's a contradictory approach because there are really two different aspects to judgment. There are really two different entities that are subject to judgment. One is the individual entity. The individual person really does have a lot to worry about, because every single individual has their own flaws and foibles, and they have to worry about how they're going to be judged for all those flaws and foibles. But on the other hand, we also have Klal Yisrael, we also have the Tzibor, we have the Rabbim, we have the more general entity. So the Rabbim, the entity of Klal Yisrael, that entity should certainly be confident that we are strong enough, especially when we are united, to be judged favorably by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, all of the happy manifestations are manifestations of putting ourselves as part of the community, and all of the manifestations of concern and of fasting and of trembling are all manifestations of our recognizing how fragile we are if we only are concerned about ourselves. If we only are focused on ourselves as individuals, then we really are in trouble. And that probably explains the very last minhag, which is mentioned in Shulchan Aruch with respect to Erev Rosh Hashanah by the Ramah, which should not be discounted at all. And based on this comment of the Lev Eliyahu, may be the most important aspect of Erev Rosh Hashanah, which will assure the happy judgment and the reason why we should go in and treat it as a semi-yontif, and that is v'nosnim shamstakol aniyim. That we should use this as a day in which we think about others, in which we think about giving staka to others, we think about charitable works, we think about what we can do in order to show that we really care about the entire klal, and that's also consistent with the comments of the Torah that at the very end of his statement, Pikach Nogin the Sapir the Chabes Erev Rosh Hashanah. And how does he end? L'chavos monos Rosh Hashanah. to make sure that it's a time that we're thinking about other people, that we're thinking about being giving gifts to others, that we're thinking about reaching out to others, that we're thinking about how can we uplift everybody else and not only be concerned about ourselves, how can we uplift the Kahal if we make sure that we have the requisite achdus, that we all care about each other, that we all care about raising up the entire community at once, then we can truly be assured in a din of a chayim tovim l'shalom for all of Klal Yisrael. Have a ksiva v'chasima tov.
We'll see everyone next week, September 13th at the GLUG event.